Hello, everyone, and welcome to Homicide Hot Dish. I'm your host, Brittany. Now, for this week's hot dish recipe, I chose a chicken cordon bleu hot dish. It's got Swiss cheese, chicken, some onion, some creamy soups, and a couple other cheeses as well. Now, I'm not a fan of Swiss cheese besides on Reuben sandwiches, but it's actually really good in this hot dish. So be sure to check out our Facebook page, Homicide Hot Dish, for that recipe. Now onto the homicide. These are the murders of Dana Woods and June Gary. Dana Woods was a strong-willed, determined 18-year-old girl from Alvin, South Carolina. When she set her mind to something, she followed through with it no matter what. According to Change.org, a pastor of Dana's says, quote, "She knew a lot of people, she was bubbly and outgoing, never a stranger," end quote. When she was just 15 years old, she enrolled in a paralegal program at Trident Technical College. She spent 2 years taking general education classes and used her summers to study and work, not what the usual teenager would be doing over the summer. She worked at Papa John's in the nearby town of Monk's Corner. She was a smart girl and she strived to ace her classes, and she had a best friend named June Gary. June Gary was a few years older than Dana. She was 22 and was also from Alvin. She only lived about a half a mile from Dana, but she had a much different life. She was a single mother to a 1.5-year-old daughter named Emma. Her daughter was the center of her world. She would do anything for her. She was working almost 40 hours a week at Walmart in Monk's Corner. And for a young, single mother, she seemed to have her life on track. But unfortunately, all of that would soon change. According to Change.org, on Sunday night, August 26, 2012, June left her home and went to Dana's house. When she got there, Dana's mom, Jennifer, had asked Dana if she would run a quick errand for her, and June goes along. The girl shouldn't be gone too long, but at 11:51 p.m., Dana calls her mom and says that they decided to stop at a drive-thru for some food and are going to give a friend a ride home. Then they'll be back home after that. June is planning on spending the night at Dana's. According to an episode of Murder Comes to Town, Dana's mom says, quote, "It was 11:51 p.m. that night and she told me that she was at the drive-thru and she said that she was going to give somebody a ride home and that she would be home shortly," end quote. But a couple hours later, the girls still aren't home. Jennifer becomes worried, so she calls Dana, but her calls go straight to voicemail. This makes her even more worried. According to that same episode, Jennifer says, quote, "By the time 3 hours had passed, I was beyond scared," end quote. At 3:30 in the morning, Dana's stepfather and mother go out looking for her, but they don't find anything, no sign of the girls. Then, about an hour later, around 4:30 a.m., they make a call to the police. A deputy of the Berkeley County Sheriff ends up meeting them at a local gas station, and he just basically tells them, you know, it hasn't really been that long, maybe they got caught up with some friends, let's just give it some more time and see if they show up. But a couple more hours go by with no sign of the girls. So Jennifer calls June's mom. Now remember, as I said earlier, June had a daughter who was about 1.5 years old, and she would not have just left her daughter like that. Around 7 o'clock in the morning, June's father and brother-in-law help look for the girls. They end up driving around some back roads in hopes of spotting Dana's car. There's so many back roads in this part of the state that it would be very easy for the girls to get lost or just lose their way. And Dana's car would be easy to spot. According to that episode of Murder Comes to Town, Dana got into an accident and her cousin repaired her car, and one of the doors on her car was a different color than the rest of the car. They end up searching for hours, and at first they think that maybe the girls got into an accident. But as more and more time went by, they become more fearful that something much worse had happened. Around 11:30 in the morning, as June's father and brother-in-law head back towards Monk's Corner, they spot Dana's car. They had just passed it on the road, so they quick make a U-turn and chase the car down, but unfortunately they lose it. And the strange thing is, they didn't see either of the girls driving the car or even in the car. They saw a young man driving. Now they're wondering who was driving Dana's car and where are the girls. After losing the car, both families go down to the police station, and this time the police take the girls' disappearance, or that they're missing, more seriously. They file an incident report and now need to find out who the young man is who was spotted driving Dana's car. Based on the description from June's father and brother-in-law, they basically just know that it was a single white male. Detectives make a list of boyfriends, friends, classmates, coworkers, anybody who was close with the girls, and they come up with a young man named Chris Feathers. According to the episode of Murder Comes to Town, Chris Feathers was Dana's on and off again boyfriend, but her mom Jennifer says she already talked with Chris and the girls aren't with him, he hasn't seen them. However, the boyfriend is usually the most obvious suspect, so detectives still want to speak with him themselves. He tells them that Dana's mom called him after the girls went missing, and he said after that, he's been trying to reach Dana but can't seem to get a hold of her either. They ask him when the last time was that he saw Dana, and he says he actually saw her the night she went missing. He was at her house around 10 p.m. that night, but after he left her house, he says he went to a friend's house and was there until about 2 a.m. Now, detectives do verify this, and Chris is eliminated as a suspect. Dana's mother ends up posting on social media asking for anybody that's seen Dana to call her right away. Her mother says they were calling all around looking for the girls, calling all their friends, anybody who may have been with them or know where they are. According to the episode of Murder Comes to Town, Dana's mom talks about June and says, quote, "She was a loving, doting mom who, just like any mother, they die for their children, and June was definitely that mom," end quote. This is why the families are so worried that something bad has happened to Dana and June. Detectives make a call to track Dana's cell phone location. While they're waiting to get the report back, they continue in their search for the girls. They go to the burger place or that drive-thru where the girls were when they called Dana's mom. They end up looking over video surveillance from the drive-thru, but they can't tell if anyone was with the girls in the video or if the girls looked panicked or distraught or anything. They seem to be at a little bit of a dead end, not really any suspects besides Dana's on and off again boyfriend who they've cleared, but then they get the report back from Dana's cell phone and detectives get a new lead. There was a ping in the Somerville side of Berkeley County on a frontage road, and this was at about 3:30 in the morning, so about 3.5 hours after Dana's mom last heard from her. So this is after the girls supposedly went missing. Now, just to give you an idea of like a map layout sort of, Monk's Corner, which is where the girls work and where they were at the drive-thru, is pretty much in the heart of Berkeley County. And Alvin, the town where both girls live, is way on the northeast side of Berkeley County, while Somerville is on the way southwest side of Berkeley County, the complete opposite of the direction they should be headed. So detectives head that way. But then a call comes in. According to the episode of Murder Comes to Town, on August 28th, not quite a full 2 days since the girls have been missing, a man calls and says he found a car located just off a road in the Francis Marion National Forest, which is about 10 miles from Dana and June's houses. The car had been completely burned to a crisp. Everything was just melted. You couldn't make out much. But eventually, detectives were able to locate a VIN number. Once they ran the VIN, they found out what they pretty much already knew, that it was Dana Woods' car. As far as they can tell, there is no body inside the car or anything. They begin searching the area for any other evidence that they can find, and they end up finding shell casings from a 9mm handgun. And not far from the car, they find what seems to be drag marks heading towards the wood line. They go over to investigate and find a body covered in branches. It's a young, white female that has a gunshot wound to the back of her head. It's Dana. Now, as far as I know, she was clothed, but they did find some of her clothing in bushes nearby. Now, this missing persons case just turned into a homicide investigation. After they found Dana's body and her burned car, the sheriff's office and Berkeley County Rescue Squad organized a search that consisted of dogs, volunteers on horses, all-terrain vehicles, people on foot. They even had a dive team search a nearby creek. Detectives can only assume that June has met the same fate, and now they need to find her body. Officers now have the horrible task of telling Dana's family that they found her remains. They go to her house and tell her mother that they found Dana's body, not that they have her little girl and she's safe, but that somebody murdered her. As you can imagine, this news devastates Dana's family, and I can only imagine what June's family was thinking after they found out what happened to Dana. Now, detectives are searching for June, and the next day, August 29th, at about 8 a.m., they get another call. This time, it's a man who was visiting a loved one in a cemetery, and this cemetery is about 10 miles from where Dana and her car were found. The man says he found a body. He says it's a young white female, and he gives a description of the clothes she was wearing and says she has a gunshot wound to the back of her head. And detectives know it's June, and once they get there, they see that it is indeed June Gary. And an interesting thing here is that June only lives about a mile or two from where her body was found. According to Live 5 News WCSC, the coroner notified June's family after finding the body. After confirming with them the clothes that June was wearing, there was no doubt that this was June's body. According to an episode of Killer in Plain Sight, the man who found June's body says he noticed a bright shirt or a sweatshirt or some type of clothing that was hanging off a branch of a tree, so he went to take a look. And that's when he saw the body. June's body was found at the bottom of a 10-foot deep dirt pit. According to Live 5 News WCSC, the coroner says, quote, "It was a shirt or a sweatshirt that was hanging up in a tree. It was like a sign that someone would want someone to come in and investigate and find her," end quote. Berkeley County spokesperson Dan Moon says, quote, "A lot of times criminals do something and want people to see what they did or find what they did. That could possibly be the case here," end quote. Now, back at the area where Dana's body and car were found, police find blood spatter evidence, and they come to the conclusion that the girls were both killed there, but for some reason, June's body was taken 10 miles away and dumped in that pit. No one can believe that this happened. Two girls had been taken from their friends and family. According to the episode of Murder Comes to Town, Dana's mom talks of how she was such a go-getter. She was the middle child, she wanted to stand out, she had two jobs to save money for law school, and had just recently graduated high school. A family friend named Sabrina Johnson even said, quote, "She was strong-willed and her dreams were important to her," end quote. Now, as I mentioned earlier, June was 4 years older than Dana. They met during Dana's freshman year of high school and quickly became friends. Dana's mom says, quote, "They met at the bus stop. About a week later, June showed up at our door wanting to see Dana. After that, June just would periodically show up at our house, or my girls Katie and Dana would walk over to June's house," end quote. Now detectives needed to try to piece together whatever they could. So far they know that the girls called Dana's mom and said they were going to get a bite to eat and then give a friend a ride. Detectives ask Dana's mom who this friend could possibly be. They ask if there is any friend that maybe lives around the area where June's dad and brother-in-law spotted Dana's car. Maybe whoever was driving it was trying to get home, and most likely the killer. He saw June's dad chasing him down and knew he was in trouble, so he had to torch the car to get rid of what evidence he could. So, who was this guy? Dana's mom brings up one person she can think of, Arthur Chavis. It seems Arthur may have had a crush on June, but she didn't return those feelings. She was maybe okay with being friends, but didn't want anything romantic with him. So it seemed he makes a pretty good suspect. According to that episode of Murder Comes to Town, detectives ask Arthur if he's heard about the girls that are missing in town, and he says yes. Then they ask if he knows the girls, and he says he knows June and that he met her at a party like 4 or 5 years ago. He then says to the investigators, "You haven't found them yet?" Which tells them that he maybe doesn't know that the girls were murdered. They then ask him what he did that weekend over the time that the girls went missing. He says he was either in bed or on the couch all weekend, which kind of sounds weird to be doing this all weekend, but he says he doesn't have a job, so he just laid around the whole weekend, watched TV, and then he was with his cousin. He says the last time he talked to June was about 2 weeks ago on the phone, and the last time he actually saw her was about a month ago. He told them that sometimes he would call her every day, which sounds a little obsessive, and I'm sure investigators are thinking, this guy is looking like a really good suspect right now. Sergeant Bobby Schuler of the Berkeley County Sheriff's Office even says it seems kind of odd. June doesn't really seem to be interested in him, but yet he calls her every day. Investigators then ask Arthur if they can take photos of him for their investigation, and he agrees to this. Their plan is to use his picture in a photo lineup, so they let Arthur go for now. Now, what they're thinking is that June's brother-in-law will point out Arthur's picture as the guy that they saw driving Dana's car. The photo lineup consists of 6 men. And according to Sergeant Gino Alteri, he says all the photos have to be similar. These men have to sort of resemble each other for them to be able to use the lineup like this. So they show the lineup to June's brother-in-law and asks if he recognizes any of the men as the one that was driving Dana's car. He points out Arthur's photo, but not because he says he was the man driving the car. He says he just recognizes him as being with June once while working at Walmart in Monk's Corner. Now, remember, Arthur's alibi is his cousin. So they talk to his cousin and do end up verifying his alibi. So that crosses him off the suspect list. Now, the leads revolving around June are pretty much non-existent at this point, so detectives start looking at people who are close with Dana. Remember, the first person they interviewed was Dana's on-and-off-again boyfriend, Chris Feathers, who they cleared. A second person on their list for Dana is Rodney Waits. Detectives were informed that Rodney may have wanted a relationship with Dana. Her parents told them that they believed Rodney had a crush on her. Rodney was a volunteer fireman at the local fire department. When detectives go to speak with him, he does admit to them that he wanted to be more than friends with Dana, but that they were not boyfriend and girlfriend, more just close friends. They ask Rodney where he was the night the girls disappeared, and he says he was asleep at the fire station, which they do verify, so that crosses him off their list now too. It seems that every suspect is just leading them no closer to the killer, or killers. On August 31st, 4 days since the girls disappeared and were murdered, everyone in town was so scared. They looked at everyone as being a suspect. This quiet town where everybody knows everybody and people don't even lock their doors has been completely shook by what happened to these two innocent girls. According to the episode of Murder Comes to Town, teenagers weren't even allowed out at night anymore. Parents weren't letting their kids out of their sights. Family friend Mary Wilson says, quote, "Nobody in our community would have done anything like that. Maybe it was a stranger just passing through," end quote. With their leads getting them essentially nowhere, detectives began looking at surveillance footage that they could find, literally anything they could find from Monk's Corner all the way to the area where Dana's car was found. They stop in at a gas station and talk to a clerk there. The clerk tells them some information that makes it sound like maybe they need to speak with their very first suspect again, Chris Feathers, Dana's on and off again boyfriend. The clerk says Chris told her that she needed to be very careful about what she tells the police. Sounds kind of suspicious, and detectives now think Chris is lying about his alibi and that his friend is lying too. Remember, Chris said he was with Dana around 10 p.m. and then went to his friend's house after that. So detectives track down Chris again, and they ask him why he told the clerk to watch what she says to them. Chris says, "Well, I heard whoever killed the girls has a brother or a cousin or something telling people not to talk to the police." And the detectives actually believe him and think that he's being genuine. They think he's actually looking out for the clerk and telling her, basically, "Hey, watch what you say because these guys might come after anyone who talks." Investigators say it was clear that Chris wanted to help. He wanted to find who was responsible for killing his girlfriend. But unfortunately, detectives have no leads and no idea where to really go from here. That is until they get another phone call. On September 1st, 6 days since the girls went missing, an employee at a gas station calls with some very interesting information. According to the episode of Murder Comes to Town, Amber Jenkins is a manager at the gas station and she tells police that there's a girl named Anna Denver who works there. Well, Anna has a boyfriend who's been telling her things about the murders that nobody else knows. It's information that hasn't been released on the news stations, newspapers, nowhere. How would her boyfriend know these things unless he's the killer or knows the killer? Anna's boyfriend is Caleb Matlock, and one day Anna reads the newspaper and sees the story of these murders that happened near Monk's Corner. She can't believe what she's reading, who would kill these two girls, and the murderer is still out there. So she starts talking to Caleb about what she's reading in the newspaper, and he ends up telling her very specific details about the deaths that aren't talked about in the article that Anna's reading. Anna then shares that information with her coworker. So detectives know that they need to talk with Anna and find out more about what Caleb has told her. They find her at her house where she lives with Caleb and their two children. While detectives are talking with her at the front door, she kind of seems distracted and like she's maybe stalling a little bit. However, she does have two children inside. I'm sure she's just sort of distracted by them. She even says she needs to tend to her kids at one point. But detectives ask her if she'd come to the station with them and talk there instead of at her house. Her mom is over at the time, so she asks her mom to watch the kids while she goes with the detectives. One of the detectives follows her out to her car, while the other detective goes inside to talk with Anna's mom and just lets her know that they're just going to talk with her quick and then they'll bring her right back when they're done. He reassures her that Anna's not in any trouble or anything, and they just need to get some information from her about her boyfriend, Caleb Matlock. And Anna's mother says, "Oh, well, he just went out the back just now." During his interview for the show, Murder Comes to Town, Sergeant Bobby Schuler says, quote, "It was a holy crap moment. I immediately run out their house out the back door, and I'm looking for him. So I'm thinking, all right, where's he at? Where's he at?" End quote. The sergeant immediately radios dispatch and tells them the way that Caleb may be heading and gives a description of what he was wearing according to Anna's mom. Caleb ends up hiding behind a dumpster at a business and starts changing his clothes when the police catch him. Now, what police find on him is a backpack, and inside that backpack, what do you think they found? A 9mm handgun. Surprise, surprise. They bring him to the sheriff's office and interview him. And they ask him how well he knows June, and he says, "Oh, we grew up together, we even dated for a little bit." And Sergeant Gino Terry says Caleb was fine with talking to them, just as long as they didn't talk about the murders. They then ask him if he knows Dana, and at first he says no, but then he says, "Well, maybe." He says he met her just once when her and June were hanging out, and he just saw her, but that was it. He never talked to her. He goes on to tell them that June actually called him the night she went missing. When the girls went to the drive-thru, she called to check on his child because it was his child's birthday. After interviewing Caleb for a little while, the detectives say to him, quote, "All right, so they get there and I guess you get up with them. What goes on after that?" End quote. And Caleb says they just started talking. And then he says, quote, "I don't want to talk about it if you don't mind." End quote. I wonder why that is. He ends up admitting that he was involved with the burning of Dana's car, and after seeing June's dad and brother-in-law make a quick U-turn and start following him, he knew he was in trouble. I even read multiple times that he ran a red light, so he definitely knew he was being followed. That's when he made the decision to take the car back to the crime scene and burn it, which he must have done as soon as June's dad and brother-in-law lost sight of him. According to the episode of Murder Comes to Town, during his interview, Caleb says, quote, "There's things I want to say, I just don't know how to push them out," end quote. He then goes on to say, quote, "Every time I'm about to say it, I just get choked up," end quote. So detectives go a different route. They say, "Okay, so you met up with the girls, then where'd you go?" And he says there's a dirt road that they used to hang out at, and that there was another guy with them that he'd never seen before. He says he doesn't even know the guy's name. So he starts putting blame on this unknown guy. But detectives aren't buying it, and even though they still play along, they say, "Okay, so tell us about this mystery guy." But instead of saying any more, Caleb says, quote, "Is it okay if I could talk to a lawyer?" End quote. So unfortunately, at this point, detectives had to end the interview. Now, in the video I watched of his interview, Caleb's body language changes once the detectives leave the room. At first, he's just sitting in a chair, just talking with them. But once they leave, he puts his hand on his head and starts kind of like rubbing his forehead and shaking his head a little bit. Then he puts his elbows on his knees and kind of grabs his head in his hands, sort of like an, oh crap, I'm in trouble kind of move. Now that Caleb asks for an attorney, detectives are more and more convinced that this is their guy, and they're thinking about this second guy that Caleb supposedly won't name. They start to think that it's not a complete lie and that there was somebody else with Caleb. So they go back to one of their first suspects, who is, coincidentally, Caleb's cousin, and who says Caleb was his alibi. So who do we know who named his cousin as his alibi? Arthur Chavis. Detectives now learn that Caleb and Arthur are cousins, each of whom were their alibis. But now detectives know that Caleb had something to do with the girls' disappearance. He burned their car, so obviously Arthur lied when he said he just laid around all weekend watching TV and hung out with his cousin. Well, maybe one part was true. He was with his cousin. Detectives track down Arthur once again and bring him in for questioning. When they sit down with him, they let him know they're not playing around anymore, no more games, you need to tell the whole truth right now. But at first, he tries to play cool and says, "What are you talking about?" And then they tell him they brought Caleb in, and they tell him a little bit of a white lie. They tell him that Caleb basically gave in and told them everything about what happened that night. Now, obviously he didn't. He didn't even give detectives Arthur's name. But they're hoping that this makes Arthur crack and he starts talking. Once detectives tell him that Caleb told them everything, he kind of gives a little head shake and just says, "Okay." They tell him that he needs to say what he knows and he just says, "I don't know anything about it." But after a while, he realizes he's pretty much caught at this point and that detectives know a whole lot more than he thought they did. So finally, he starts to cave. According to the Murder Comes to Town episode, he says, quote, "I didn't know he was gonna kill him," end quote. There it is, what detectives needed. It seems that he is kind of pointing the finger at Caleb, and Caleb was kind of pointing the finger at him, being the mystery guy at the time. So detectives need to find out exactly what happened, who pulled the trigger, what did they do after and before, all of it. Arthur says he knew Caleb was going to take Dana's car, but that he didn't know that he was going to shoot them. He says they were just going to rob the girls and steal the car and then actually use the car to go commit more crimes. They wanted to get money to fix up Caleb's car, is what I read. Arthur says he and Caleb got in the car with Dana and June, and that at some point, Caleb said, "Hey, I lost my wallet in the woods somewhere. Could you guys give me a ride to go look for it?" Arthur says that Caleb told the girls that he was going to give them $50 if they'd take him there. So the girls agree, and Arthur says they were all kind of joking around and having a good time while they were driving to the woods, just as friends would do. Arthur then says, quote, "I was all doped up. I was walking slow, and he just shot him," end quote. He says after that, at some point, Caleb drops him off and keeps Dana's car and then eventually ends up burning it. That's it. That's all that Arthur says. Basically, Caleb wanted to steal the car and rob the girls, so he killed them. Chief Rick Olick with the Berkeley County Sheriff's Office says he doesn't believe that's all there is to the story. He doesn't believe that Caleb just killed them just for the car and that there is probably more that happened in the woods that night that we may never know. So, just to put this into perspective, Arthur lives about 4 miles from where Dana's body and car were found. So, after this happened, Caleb kills the girls, Arthur just goes home, knowing that only a few miles away lays Dana's body. After their interviews on September 1st, 2012, Caleb and Arthur are arrested. They're both only 23 years old and they have just ruined their lives. According to Change.org, June's father says, quote, "I think they just wanted to cause a scene. I have no idea why Dana was down there and June was up here a mile behind our house," end quote. He also says he wants to know why. Why did they kill these two girls? Why did they take June 10 miles away from Dana and her car? Why did they leave June's shirt on a tree? June's father says, quote, "It's not going to make a lot of difference, but I want to know. I have no clue what caused these kids to do what they did," end quote. In August 2014, 25-year-old Caleb Matlock's trial begins. He pleads guilty and says he does this to spare the families from the pain of sitting through a trial, and he feels that this would give them closure. Now, if this would have gone to trial and a jury found him guilty of murdering the girls, it would have been a mandatory sentence of life in prison. So is he really pleading guilty to spare the girls' families, or is he just trying to save himself? According to the Berkeley Observer, Caleb says he just wants it to be over, and he says, quote, "Truth is, this eats me up inside. It always has. Sorry doesn't even cut it, but I am. I am really sorry. I'm going to live the rest of my life in hell, whether it's living or not," end quote. But the girls' families don't buy his apology or whatever that was. June's sister, Rachel Gary, says, quote, "You want to do the right thing? The right thing is you should have let her come home to us. You could have had that car. We could have replaced that car, but we can't replace her life," end quote. At Caleb's sentencing, Dana's mother, Jennifer, is so upset she holds up a picture of her daughter and demands that Caleb look at it, but he just looks at the floor. According to monstersandcritics.com, June's sister, Rachel Gary, says to him, quote, "You come to our house, we babysat you. You can't even tell us why you did this to our sister. She cannot see her daughter grow up. She don't get to spend no more birthdays with her. I don't know why you killed my sister. She was my world, my best friend. We did everything together. I took care of her and her daughter. You get to live your life while we work every day and pay for you to sit there and have 3 meals a day, lights, while we're out here struggling to take care of a little girl who don't have her mother no more," end quote. The maximum sentence Caleb could face is life in prison. According to the Post and Courier, June's father says, quote, "Not only did he kill my youngin', but he took her and dumped her in a hole. Life in prison ain't nothing. He's still alive. He should be hung. He really messed up some lives," end quote. The judge ends up sentencing Caleb to 5 years in prison for each possession charge, 15 years for arson, 30 years for armed robbery, and 55 years for each murder charge, all served concurrent, meaning that after serving 55 years, he would go free. Caleb will be in prison until August 2067, when he will be 78 years old. According to the episode of Killer in Plain Sight, since being incarcerated, Caleb has been disciplined numerous times for many minor offenses and has spent periods in isolation. So prison hasn't really been treating Caleb well, which I don't think disappoints anyone. Now on to Caleb's accomplice, Arthur Chavis. Arthur has his preliminary hearing in April of 2015, and at first he tries to fight the charges that are against him rather than making a plea deal right away like Caleb. According to the episode of Killer in Plain Sight, he says he had no idea that Caleb was going to shoot the girls. He still maintains his innocence on that part. And his lawyers say there's nothing connecting him to the murders, nothing to show that he had anything to do with killing those girls. But the charges against him are not dropped, meaning that he would go to trial. So to avoid this, he pleads guilty and is charged with voluntary manslaughter, armed robbery, and possession of a firearm. According to the Berkeley Observer, during Arthur's sentencing hearing, Dana's mother, Jennifer, addresses him and says, quote, "As I've waited these last 2 years, 7 months, and 26 days, I have only wondered why. Why did you two pick these two beautiful girls? June was a single mom who was just trying to raise her daughter right and doing a dang good job at it. Dana, who had just turned 18 2 months prior, was close to finishing her paralegal degree and was on her way to law school with a 3.8 GPA. My why will never be answered because you and Matlock decided to plea. That's fine because that may have saved both our families additional pain," end quote. She goes on to say, quote, "You might not have pulled the trigger that night, but you might as well have. You knew we were out searching for Dana and June, but you did nothing to come forward and help us find them. You could have told us where they were, and you might not be sitting here today. You two didn't just ruin your own lives, you've scarred the hearts of parents, grandparents, siblings, and friends," end quote. Arthur just kept his head down and never even apologized to the girls' families. Arthur Chavis was sentenced to 25 years in prison. He will be eligible for release in November of 2033 when he will be 46 years old. Now, as you can imagine, the girls' families are not satisfied with these sentencings. I mean, They'll each get out eventually. They killed two innocent girls and still will get to live their lives. Arthur will be in his mid-40s, Caleb will be in his late 70s. I mean, sure, a lot of time would have passed, especially for Caleb, but still, he'll be free and alive. The families felt that these two men should have gotten life in prison. And Dana's mother actually created a petition asking legislatures to toughen the minimum punishments for murder convictions. There is a YouTube video that I believe Dana's mother put out to support her petition. It's titled Justice for Dana and June, and it says, quote, "Moms, dads, grandmas, grandpas, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, and cousins. Imagine for just a moment that your whole life is about to change. As you read every word, imagine this is happening to you. For just a few minutes, take a walk in my shoes." On August 26, 2012, it was a typical Sunday around our house. That night, Dana was playing video games and June came to hang out with us for a while. Later that night, around 10:45, I needed Dana to run an errand for me and June decided to ride along. The kids finished the errand and stopped to get a treat from Burger King. At 11:51, you get a call from your child. They are at the drive-thru and joking around with you and the manager. Your child then tells you they are going to give a friend a ride home and come straight home. You call to tell the kids to hurry up and come home. They don't answer. You try one cell phone and then the other. You call constantly, no more than 3 minutes between calls to each of their cell phones. Your child and their friend are missing. You just talked to your child a few hours before and she said they were coming home soon. Hours later, you and the other family are filing a police report. The car was spotted and disappeared. You are desperate. Both families are out searching for days. It's all you do. Everything within you says these children are fighters. They will be okay, but your heart aches to hold them both. Days later, the police tell you the car was found burned in the woods. No sign of the children. Hours later, they have found a body. You don't know what to think. Hours later, the coroner is at your house telling you it's your child. Questions fill your head. So many thoughts. What happened? Where is the other child? You pray. The next day, the other child is found. Grief consumes you. You pray. The days that follow are all a blur. You plan a funeral. You purchase flowers. You ask to put favorite items and letters in the casket. The sheriff's office made an arrest. Two cousins did this to your child and her friend. They led them into the woods to look for a lost wallet. The kids just wanted to help. The police said the cousins just wanted the car. They wanted to rob someone. They wanted money to fix their car and be street racers. Almost 2 years pass. Time for court. You are ready to see the guy who did this get a life sentence. This is what you hear the judge say. Possession of a firearm in the commission of a violent crime. 5 years concurrent with credit for time served. Arson in the third degree, 15 years, concurrent with credit for time served. Armed robbery, 30 years, concurrent with credit for time served. Murder, each charge, 55 years, concurrent with credit for time served. Please stand with us, sign this petition, and share with everyone you know. We don't want another family to have to hear anything like this again, end quote. Now, unfortunately, I don't believe Jennifer's petition changed the law. The law previously stated that a person who is convicted of or pleads guilty to murder must be punished by death or by a mandatory minimum term of imprisonment for 30 years to life. Jennifer wanted to have this changed to a minimum of 50 years for each life taken. However, all I could find was that the law still states 30 years. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Homicide Hot Dish. Be sure to stay tuned in on our Facebook page, Homicide Hot Dish, for when future episodes will be coming out.